Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, January 8th. We are learning more about the proposed deal between Hawaii Pacific Health and the state's largest health insurer, HMSA, why Queens and which is the state's trauma center, is objecting. We talk about those sewer fee hikes and the idea that the city may move to expand the current landfill site here on Oahu. We pause to consider the impact of the action the U.S. took in Venezuela this past week and the charter school challenge. We take the long view on a clash over the need for more classroom space. Plus, the new film heads to Maui, and it tells the story behind the first Micronesian woman to explore the deepest part of the Pacific Ocean, the Marianas Trench. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The headlines about a deal in the works between HMSA and Hawaii Pacific Health is raising eyebrows about what it means for healthcare in the state. HPR's Ashley Mizuo was at a news conference yesterday where executives announced the plan. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, and right after that, right, we heard from Queens and the Nurses Union. Everybody wanted to weigh
in. Yes, yes. And so, you know, kind of to like figure out what is going on here. So HMSA, you know, the state's largest insurer, is coming together with Hawaii Pacific Health to create a nonprofit parent organization called One Health Hawaii. They were very clear that this is not a merger and to call it a partnership or an affiliation. HMSA President Dr. Mark Mugui, she says it's an effort to make healthcare, you know, more affordable and more accessible. You know, both him and HPH President Ray Vara say that, you know, this kind of partnership would mean that the controversial insurance practice of prior authorization, which is when, you know, healthcare providers need approval from insurers before they can deliver actual medical services or medications, it may no longer be an issue for Hawaii Pacific Health patients. But you might be wondering, okay, so what happens if you're on HMSA, but you seek care from providers outside of HPH? Mugui, she says that the new partnership would be an open system, meaning that providers outside of HPH will be able to participate.
At HMSA, we know we pay one-third of our dollars to Queens, one-third of our dollars to independent providers, and one-third of our dollars to Hawaii Pacific Health. There is no universe in the world that where we can say, well, we'll just take two-thirds of them and not have them anymore. We need all of them. We need 100% of the providers to come along. We want our members to be able to see the doctor of their choice, to go to the facility of their choice.
You know, HPH President Ray Vara says that it could really alleviate some of the administrative burdens on both HPH and HMSA that could result in billions of dollars of cost savings over several years, which they plan to put into three different investments. One of them is lowering the insurance rates, and then second is reinvesting this into the state's healthcare system, like adding more specialty doctors on neighboring islands, and then third is investing in social determinants of health, like education or workforce development. He said that they are not anticipating having any layoffs at HPH or HMSA if the partnership does go through, even though it's going to result in a consolidation of administrative services. They say that, you know, natural attrition will be able to kind of do that for them, essentially.
Yeah, so talk about the pushback.
Yeah, so, you know, Queens Health Systems opposes the proposed partnership. Queens Health has a payer mix that includes a lot more vulnerable populations. Like, they have a lot more Medicaid and Medicare or uninsured patients. And it's really the patients who are on private health insurance that support the health system's critical services. Queens Health Systems President Jason Chang says that if HPH becomes HMSA's preferred network, it could push away some of those commercial patients. So for example, like HPH, if it was now the preferred network of HMSA, they could have no copays or no prior authorization or no insurance claim denials, which would be different than everyone else who, you know, you can still see your Queens doctor, but you wouldn't have necessarily the same, you know, like prior, you still have to do prior authorization, you still have to do copays, things like that. And that could lead commercial patients away from, you know, the Queens health system to a new entity. And that could make Queens a safety net hospital, which would impact its ability to provide services.
if 5% of our commercial business were to shift, it's approximately $50 million of impact. And so you think about these core services and these critical services. Critical services are those safety net services like behavioral healthcare and trauma. If you can't support some of those programs, I think hard decisions have to be made.
And that's true. I mean, it's a trauma level one trauma center, right? It has critical mental health services.
Right. And I think that that is also like a huge reason why Queens already has such a large payer mix of Medicaid and Medicare patients or those who are uninsured, because it does offer a lot of those behavioral health treatments that you know, HPH or other hospitals do not offer. And so they're saying basically, like, if this partnership results in more commercial patients from Queens moving over to Hawaii Pacific Health, it would really hurt their financial stability. And that shift in client share is also something that the Hawaii Medical Association, which represents physicians in Hawaii, is concerned about. Here's HMA President Dr. Nadine Tinsel.
Physicians worry about reduced competition over time, fewer choices for both patients and physicians, shifts in commercial patients that leave safety net providers and health systems carrying a disproportionate Medicaid burden, increased consolidation pressures on independent and rural practices that may unintentionally be the straw that breaks the camel's back for many private practices in our rural communities or neighbor islands, which will expand what are already existing healthcare deserts.
And then Rosalie Agnes Yu, who is the president of the Hawaii Nurses Association, was concerned about what this partnership might mean for their union contracts, which they recently won. You know, think about like the Kapi'olani nurses strike. They say that it's possible that if this partnership were to go into effect, that HPH could tell the nurses union that they need to come back to the bargaining table and basically renegotiate their contract. But on the other hand, they could also decide to honor that contract as well. They're just not quite sure like what this partnership would mean for those union contracts and what that would mean for the nurses that work at Hawaii Pacific Health. So when we're looking at, you know, what happens next after this, you know, HPH and HMSA are going to have several regulatory steps to complete before this partnership is actually finalized. It's going to need approval by state agencies and the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice. I believe SHPDA, the state health planning department here in Hawaii, is going to be overseeing a lot of this transition, a lot of the regulatory steps. I spoke with Jamie Godwin, who is a senior analyst on hospital costs at KFF, a nonpartisan policy research, polling, and news organization.
The economists at the FTC will take a look at proprietary claims data from the merging parties. They'll take a look at competitors in the area. They'll look at financial information and do a lot of modeling to try to predict what the outcomes might be and whether there could be harm to patients or employers in the form of anti-competitive high prices or unfair practices such as steering patients to a preferred provider group or health system.
And so, you know, he says that the integration of health plans and hospitals is a more recent development. So there's the research is really still catching up. So it's hard to speak on the outcomes. You know, nationally speaking, there's been a consolidation of services kind of broadly, but not necessarily where a health plan like an insurer and a hospital are coming together to create this new entity. When they were announcing what this partnership would be, they said, Dr. Mark Mugiishi said that it's to fight against climbing insurance rates. They say that the rates have been increasing between 12 and 30%. And one of the things they said about why this is so necessary, this partnership, is because HMSA did not want to be, you know, gobbled up by a large for-profit insurance company on the continent. And so they're saying that this partnership would possibly help with staving off some of that. And one of the interesting things that Dr. Tinsel was saying from Hawaii Medical Association is that it's not necessarily that HMA is against this partnership, because the premise, wanting to correct like lower interest,
bring the cost down, right?
Get down, yeah. Expand affordability, expand services. These are all premises that, you know, that's things that everyone is on board with. They are saying that, you know, the premise of this partnership is not the issue, but they're unsure if the partnership is a way forward to solve some of these problems.
Yeah, there could be some unintended consequences. And, you know, I'm still a little hazy. I mean, will this new model or new partnership be similar to like what Kaiser offers, you know, HMO kind
of
thing?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, yes, because it would be a partnership with HMSA and HPH and they would be tied together. But like they said, it's going to be an open system. So unlike Kaiser, you know, you can only see Kaiser doctors. They're saying that the hospitals that they're contracted with. So if Queens ends up contracting with this new entity, like you could still see your Queens doctor or all the private practices that do. And they're saying that those are necessary to make this come to fruition. They can't lose some of these providers because, you know, already there's so little healthcare in the state.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, Queens has its master plan and expansion plan, and how will that affect those types of things going forward?
Right, right.
Yeah, fascinating. All right, well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you so much.
We've been hearing from HR's Ashley Mazua. You can read her coverage online at hawaiipublicradio.org. And a note, HMSA and Hawaii Pacific Health are HPR underwriters.
This is Ira Glass. On This American Life, we look for stories that are surprising, that you won't hear anywhere else. Like, for example, this one astronaut who went to the moon. You know what he's not into? Space.
Was it cool to float around weightless?
No.
Unexpected stories every week. This American Life.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than three decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance. An HPR supporter since 2001.
This month, Oahu residents and businesses will see a 6% rate hike to their sewer bill. It's the first hike in about a decade. The city set a schedule for the next 5 years to raise billions to fix an aging sewer system and make upgrades mandated by new environmental laws. Just a few weeks ago, we saw a break in a sewage pipe near Nimitz Highway that spilled close to 250,000 gallons of wastewater into the Nu'uanu Stream. We talked to Roger Babcock, director of the city's Environmental Services Department, this morning to remind us why this hike is in place.
Some of the upgrades are required to replace old things, and some of the upgrades are required for new regulations and new and evolving regulations, which we're always having to keep up with.
And to remind our listeners, I mean, you know, we had problems with our Sand Island treatment plant, right? We were under a consent decree. We had that break in Waikiki. And these are threats to our environment and our economic engine.
Correct. So maintaining the sewer system and treatment plants and everything that's involved with it, the collection system, the pump stations and the treatment plants and the disposal and reuse and all that is really important for the overall health of public health and the environment, right? So we don't want to pollute the environment partly because of the environment itself, but also because we are part of the environment and we interact with it, right? So we need to make sure that public health is protected. So that's very important. And it's a highly regulated industry, just like drinking water and air pollution, where there are lots of requirements that we have to meet. And the consent decree is part of that. So it resulted from a lot of things that happened at that time, a long time ago. But it is a legal agreement document in federal court that says we will do certain things. We've completed 2/3 of that, the collection system portion, which was the first 10 years from 2010 to 2020. And then the second portion was our big treatment plant out here in Ewa Beach, the Honolulu'i treatment plant. That was completed in 2024. On time and on budget, both of those parts. And the last part to finish, the third part, is the Sand Island wastewater treatment plant upgrade. And that is well underway, and part of that is nearly complete, and there are basically two big phases, and phase one is nearly complete. So we are on schedule to complete all that work by 2035 as required.
And when the city set this schedule for the hikes over these number of years, I mean, it was really with the thought that it has to be done. We don't really have much wiggle room.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's correct. We have these things that are required that we need to do, that we have to do, and not just the things that we're being told we have to do. It's also being proactive, too. So we avoid failures and spills and all those things. And that's a big challenge with, as you mentioned, with aging infrastructure.
Well, I think everybody is worried about pocketbook issues because of inflation and the cost of everything and tariffs, et cetera. And I think it's just being cognizant of why these rates are going to go up this month. And I know that, you know, you had the news conference yesterday with Ernie Lau, our chief engineer for the Board of Water Supply. And we're trying to make this less painful for people, for users. And the hike does go after the large users.
Exactly. So what we tried to do with the, we changed the way the rates, the sewer fees work. And what we did is we tried to reduce the base charge, which is the charge that you have no control over, and increase the volumetric charge, which is based on how much water you use. And the idea there is to give folks control, greater control of their sewer bill, right? So if it was 100% fixed charge, then you have absolutely no control. You pay the same amount every month, no matter how much water you use. Whereas if you have a much smaller portion that is fixed, then that means that it's almost all based on how much water you use, which you do have control over. So that's the idea, is if you use less, then you pay less.
Will there be any additional programs for needy families or hardship cases?
Yes, thanks for asking. So we, in addition to giving tips on how to conserve water, which is important, because especially if you change devices, right, because then that's a permanent savings that you will have forever. It'll just keep saving and saving. For the hardship situation, we're introducing a program that we call CARES, Customer Assistance for Residential Environmental Services, which isn't kicked off yet. We're in the process of trying to get a contractor online to get this program started as soon as we can. And that will let folks who qualify with lower household incomes, less than 80% of their area median income, to qualify for a credit each month on the fixed portion of their bill of $20.
Okay, so the city plans to roll out that program in the weeks or months to come.
Exactly.
Okay. And I do have to ask you about solid waste, because there was a public notice that talked about possible expansion of the current landfill on the west side, and that's been a bit of bone of contention, and that hearing is next week. What's the city's position on this?
Yeah, so right now that specific meeting is not about the expansion of the landfill. It's about a prior expansion that happened, which gives the landfill that we have today. So that's a routine quarterly meeting that's happened for about 10 years to inform the public of what's going on at the existing landfill. So further information about what will happen next with the landfill and the future will be coming out soon separately from the city.
But we note that the rules, the laws that the lawmakers have passed in recent years really makes it tough for the city, because you can't site a landfill right over an aquifer. You can't make it too close to the residential areas, that kind of thing. So you don't have very much choice out there.
There's not a lot of choices, and they keep diminishing, getting smaller. But we will have a plan. We will have a solution. That's our job and what we have to do, and we will get it done. So again, I think we're going to be coming out with that very soon, because time is ticking away. And so we'll be making an announcement sometime in the near future.
Okay. I'm wondering if that'll be in the State of the City address by the mayor, but we'll look for that.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Roger. Anything else that you want to address?
I would just say, you know, again, with the sewer bills, you know, it's necessary, it's important, and we appreciate people's support, and to remember to use less and you'll pay less. And then, you know, on the solid waste side, you know, it's really important. We do have to have a landfill, but everybody can do their part to do more recycling, right? So whatever we can recycle, we really need to recycle. And that involves everybody. That's a, you know, that's a public thing, and we appreciate everyone's support in doing that and hope that we will be able to continue that and recycle more.
That was Roger Babcock, head of the city's Environmental Services Department, which covers solid waste and wastewater. Those sewer hikes that we talked about will be 6% this year, going up to 9% in the years to come. Look for links on our website about the hikes later today to learn more.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Tessa Thompson. She stars as a former news anchor back in the public eye after a murder in the new Netflix series His and Hers. We'll also talk about her career, including her acclaimed turn as Hedda Gabler and why she's drawn to playing powerful, complicated women. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
I'm Anita Rao. Embodied is WUNC's weekly radio show and podcast about sex, relationships, and health. Join me to meet people who aren't afraid to question what we think we know about intimacy, who are embracing the unique ways their bodies shape their lived experience, and who have some fascinating stories to share about their relationships. We'll take on the taboo together next time on Embodied.
Beginning this evening at 7.
This weekend, the Honolulu Defense Forum will kick off a gathering of military, technology, and government leaders to talk about security in the Indo-Pacific. That topic takes on new meaning with the recent military action by the U.S. on Venezuelan soil. We reached out to the East-West Center to better understand how the U.S. operation and arrest of Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro and his wife could impact what happens in our own region. Carlos Suarez's family hails from Mexico, and he's worked in Colombia and studied in Venezuela, and he also served as honorary consul of Peru to Hawaii and the Pacific. We asked about his thoughts on the latest developments.
It's a pretty significant event. Maybe I want to put it in this bigger context. It represents a transition to a system, an international system, which we've seen before in most of the 19th and early 20th century, a system in which powerful countries run spheres of influence. In other words, carve up the world in some way. It's a very much a system we saw that, you know, brought its own balance of power, but also problems and challenges, and, you know, ended with the culmination of the two world wars. I'm, you know, not saying that alone is it, but we've lived in a world where for the last 75, 80 years, we've had this system in place that is now suddenly being confronted with, you know, just severe challenges to, you know, whether, you know, the legitimacy or just, you know, the big power. This is great power politics, and it reflects a clear determination that the U.S. will do what it wants to in the hemisphere. In other words, part of we saw the recent national security strategy that made very clear it codified the Western Hemisphere as not only a core U.S. security priority, but also an exclusive domain. And I guess that's one way to think of it, where people in China or followers of China and Taiwan and maybe others looking at Russia, is this something that would signal to them? Again, it's hard to say, but that's one thought, that this is kind of turning us back to a time, you know, and also a message, and maybe another way, that the U.S. is willing to do what it needs to maintain both, you know, influence and access, and access to natural resources, and that it has the military force to do so. So, yeah, it's a pretty significant event, and it's fast-moving. There's so many different pieces of it that it's really hard to even, you know, grasp it. But it is the so-called Trump corollary, the idea that it's a version of the Monroe Doctrine that is essentially promises to deny non-hemispheric competitors, which is China and Russia, access to the region.
Well, as you know, the Defense Forum is about to kick off. I'm sure there are folks that are a bit nervous about what this may mean for this region out here in the Pacific, because when it comes to diplomacy, it just got so much harder with the events of this past week.
Yeah, I mean, it is, a bit of uncertainty. And, you know, one curious thing, too, is it was interesting that when the event took place, that is the capture of this president of Venezuela, Maduro, there was a Chinese delegation basically in Caracas, Venezuela, that woke up that morning to experience the same thing. And I guess, I mean, I would just add this, that, you know, China, of course, does have, as a major global power, it has a very, very strong engagement economically with Latin America, with South America specifically. It is a major foreign investor, particularly countries like Bolivia and Peru and the Andes with a lot of minerals, and Venezuela, primarily the oil. What I'm getting at there is that it's deep engaged, and over the last 25, 30 years, the U.S. has largely neglected or really looked the other way towards the region post 9/11. Understandably, the U.S. foreign policy focused on the Middle East and Europe, transatlantic issues, and then Asia. Meanwhile, Latin America, kind of in the back burner, this suddenly puts it right back on the front burner for the moment. And, you know, with a Secretary of State himself, Cuban-American, that, you know, has his own, I guess, longstanding, basically, understanding of the region in an interesting way where, you know, this is playing out very strongly for him in ways that other parts of the world are not, Russia or, let's say, Asia. But this is Marco Rubio's maybe area of, focus.
Latin America, you know, is your area of expertise. How are you seeing this? Because we've already heard President Trump call out Mexico should be warned. And so how are you looking at this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just maybe one way of saying that the perspective from Latin America is, of course, it's going to be wide-ranging and mixed. And that's because you have both a long historical context of U.S. engagement in the region with military interventions, but also support for different kinds of governments. And today, I think what you're seeing, on one hand, as I said earlier, Trump is clearly dead serious about implementing essentially his Trump corollary. In other words, make no mistake, and this is nothing new. He's been saying it for a while, and now it's in practice. But basically, what you could say is that in less than a year, Latin America has transformed from being a perpetual backwater of our U.S. grand strategy. Again, it hasn't been on the front burner for a long time, since the 80s when we had all the engagement in Central America. And in effect, it has now become one of its main theaters. As I said earlier, it's now very much a core part of our security policy. The other thought, maybe within Latin America, again, you're going to see leaders who cater to U.S. demands, and there are some who we've seen President Trump closely connected more to Argentine President Javier Milei, Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele. Those will be rewarded, and they have been. Those who don't, including Maduro, Cuban President, the Colombian President, Gustavo Petro, they're going to continue to face intense U.S. economic and rhetorical pressure. You know, what's also interesting is, again, this is all happening in a very, you could say, we don't see any attention to issues of democracy or development or somehow even who's choosing the leaders. Yeah, it's very stark. It's power and again, just mixed signals coming from even the U.S. administration about what comes next. It's going to be a very, you know, again, it's a clear example of less driven by spreading democracy and institutional regional economic integration. That's been the agenda for a couple of decades now. Now it's more about exercising raw power, and that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's what some people are wringing their hands over. They see it as a pure power grab, whether it's Greenland or Venezuela and its oil. But it just may make some people in our area here in the Pacific nervous about what's next.
Yeah, and again, uncertainty and just a different way of dealing, you know, very transactional, as we often hear that phrase. But, I think for the region, again, it's also, you mentioned these other countries, you know, Mexico, they've been singled out by the U.S., by Trump specifically, in ways that probably has a lot of them nervous and very ways that we haven't seen before. There is a fair amount of fear. And of course, longer term, Latin American countries are going to reassess their own limited ability to deter U.S. military attacks. Nobody's going to stop the U.S. from doing what it wants. But a generation from now, the region may be less beholden to the U.S. and have more, not fewer, links to other players. Because, you know, one of the things we're seeing play out, not just in Latin America, but elsewhere, is reassessing, you know, who are your partners and allies. And so we're going to see a continent that fears the U.S. rather than sees it as a powerful partner. And that, you know, I mean, it's hard to say if that's going to bode well for our long-term strategic interests. Maybe last point I would say is that traditionally, you know, in the policymaking process of our government, we traditionally have a national security process that, you know, goes through some measure of, you know, assessing all the ins and outs and possibilities. And, you know, I can't speak for certainty, but, you know, this decision, just to me, I can't help but think a lot of things weren't carefully thought out. You know, we don't have clarity on the next day, you know, I'm not the next day, but, you know, the plan of what's going to follow and mixed signals. And part of that reflects, again, that today our foreign policy is just not being driven by a, you know, a process where, you know, expertise and let's say, you know, different, clear options that a president wants. This is a president that doesn't generally look at that and, you know, doesn't carry out his foreign policy in that way. So harder to gauge, harder to understand, and yeah, just a different style altogether.
Okay. Anything else that you think is important to underscore?
Well, again, I think the uncertainty of what could follow. I mean, we just don't know. It really has a lot of puzzles that we don't have certainty on. Is this a regime change? Apparently not. Is it just a dictator change or a leader change? And are we going to work with Sue? And just so many puzzles there. And, the, you know, again, this question of what could happen, worst-case scenarios, we could find ourselves engaged in a protracted guerrilla war and, you know, and with all these other geopolitical actors engaged. I mean, again, I can't be sure what's going to happen, but there's a lot of pressure also, and maybe mixed pressure, because huge diaspora Venezuelans who have been pushed out in the last 15, 20 years, many need to come back and want to come back, but they need to make sure they're coming back to a country that they can, you know, govern and have a say in. And right now that remains to be seen, you know, what's going to follow.
That was Carlos Suarez, who currently serves as the Interim Director of Research and Grants at the East-West Center. He spoke with us about his thoughts on the recent events in Venezuela and the uncertainty that remains in the region and beyond. And full disclosure, East-West Center is an HPR underwriter. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. It was 30 years ago that Hawaii saw its first charter school. And here to talk about that this morning on The Long View is HPR's contributing editor, Neil Milner. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning.
Yeah, so that school is in my neighborhood. And
yes.
It's fascinating when you think that we've had charter schools now for 30 years.
Yes, you have. And charter schools have grown dramatically, while the public schools enrollment has declined fairly dramatically. And in some ways, you still have the same problems that charter schools had in 1995. And in some ways, because of that enrollment difference, problems have gotten worse. And I'm really going to base this discussion on a recent article in Civil Beat about the concern over space. So that's a very specific issue. So let's start there. Look at it this way. When you walk or drive by a public school, you can tell it's a public school, right? It's pretty simple. You know what the buildings look like. If you drive by a strip mall, you might see a dentist office. You might see a poke place. You might also see a charter school buried in there, because charter schools don't really have the regular access to buildings. While I was a little bit of an exception, they don't have a regular access to buildings because they get some money from the state for their schools, but not money for their buildings and not money for maintenance. They have to pay for that out of their own budget. So there are two different kinds of schools, charter and public, and you'll never see them in the same building. And that's what the charter schools are trying to change. Because, as this article pointed out, the DOE has slack space because of the enrollment declining. The charter schools are growing, and they need more space. But the answer has not been that the DOE has been willing to open the space. And the fundamental reason for this, and you have to understand this about charter schools and the public schools, they're in competition. There are two kinds of organizations that are competing with each other for resources and for students. They're both in the education business, but in very different ways. And so trying to get them to cooperate, and the legislature has told the DOE, use some of these spaces, let some of these spaces go to charter schools, let them be in your buildings. Even though the legislature has said that to the DOE, has not been willing to do that. They're not been willing to do that, not just because they're worried about charter schools as competition, but because public schools have different missions in some ways and operate differently. It's like an unhealthy merger. But different, think about some of the missions that a public school has. One of the things is it has to educate everybody. It has to educate, and it has to have schools in a neighborhood. People use public schools in ways that are beyond the education itself. They might want to send their kid out of the neighborhood because the grandparents live somewhere else and they can pick the kid up after school. But people are very attached to the idea of a neighborhood school. And if the DOE takes this slack space in a school that they would like to use for something else, but they can't fill it with their own students, and allows the closes down the school for low enrollment things, which is a third rail here. And if you close a public school, it's vacant, and then so that the people in the neighborhood have to go somewhere else, and then you give it to a charter school, that ticks off the neighborhood, it ticks off all kinds of people. That's essentially what's going on, that it's two different kind of operations in the education business, but competing with one another because the system is set up to force them to compete with one another. That's the simple issue. I mean, that's the kind of concrete issue. We'll talk about what's behind this in a minute if you got any questions.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the rub, right? I mean, the only other school that, the charter school that I can think of right off that has a structure like a regular school is University Lab School, but that's at University of Hawaii.
That's right,
Manoa
it's
campus.
An existing space. If you started a school, if a public school converted to the charter system, and the public school, of course, already had the space, that's easy to do. If you're a charter school, like the small one that's lots of small ones around, and like the one at a technology school in Kalihi, you got no space. You have to pay for it, or you have to try to get the DOE to give you some slack space, but that costs money. That's where the problem is. And even if the schools are partly online, it still is a problem. So the real question is, how good are the charter schools anyway, and why are they so popular? That's a more complicated question, because good is something that is defined differently by everybody else. If you look nationally at charter schools and how well they perform on standardized tests, charter schools tend to be on one extreme or the other. That is, they don't center in the middle so much. There's a group of outliers that are tremendously good, and there's a group of outliers that are tremendously bad.
Mm-hmm.
Hawaii follows something like that pattern. It's never been a high-scoring school system overall compared to nationally, but there are some charter schools that have failed. But there's at least one school, the Myron Thompson Charter School here, that is nationally known and nationally acclaimed. So when you send your kid to a charter school, you're not necessarily getting a better education in terms of school performance. But here's where the thing gets more complicated. Charter schools are created to some extent for special interest, for special objectives, for special kinds of values. You're interested in your kid learning more about Hawaiian technology or more about Hawaiian culture. You're interested in your kid doing more math. You're interested in your kid having a more open set of education. That doesn't necessarily show up in the performance scores, and you may not care that it doesn't show up in the performance scores. As the charter school people say, we have our own measures of what's good and what's not. So you run into this complicated mix. On the one hand, there are firm believers, and this has been a part of conservative thinking for a long time. We're talking pre-Trump conservative, and in the case of Trump, who knows what he thinks about this, although they haven't been very active about public education. Conservatives believe in choice. They believe in privatization. They believe in the sector doing things better. And they look at public schools nationally, and they say, they're not doing very well. The whole system should be choice. If the government's going to do anything, it gives you money so you as an individual can pick schools. So that's one argument. And some people are willing to carry that as far as it would go, where essentially you would eliminate the public school system. The other thing that makes it more complicated is people say public education made this country great. We're committed to the notion that everybody should have an education and that the schools are a place, the public schools especially, are a place where you meet a diverse group of people and your fellow students and learn from them. That was actually part of one of the reasons we sent our kids to public schools in Hawaii. All of that mix, plus the fact that resources are more scarce, makes you understand better why this individual problem over space is not really an individual problem at all. It's a kind of awkward merger. That is, you can't simply say, well, in an education business, you're not using that space. We are. We'd like to use it. And when the DOE says we'd like to use it for something else, that's not just about space. It's about this whole fundamental issue about how do we educate our kids and what does it mean to educate our kids. By the way, a quick note. When my granddaughter, when they lived in Brooklyn, she went to a really good public school across the street that shared its space with the charter school. Hmm. And it was, there were space issues, but that's the way it worked there.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, what's the answer, right, going forward?
I don't know. It's much harder for parents now. But you also have to remember that whatever the scores are, in public schools, people have an attachment to their neighborhood school. Just as whatever crime rates are, people tend to think that their neighborhood is safer than the other neighborhoods. You become attached to a place, and the public school has always been that kind of place. And that's a hard thing to, and maybe not a good thing to try to change.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Food for thought. All right. Thank you so much, Neil.
You're welcome. Take care of yourself.
We've been hearing from our contributing editor, Neil Milner, on The Long View.
On the next Radiolab.
This is going to get weird down to the fabric.
ChatGPT-3.
GPT-4.
You think Apple Intelligence.
These systems don't have the common sense of a mouse.
What would an AI autopsy show us about how they think?
AI cannot suffer and rejoice in the same way that humans can.
That's a good way of looking at AI. Profoundly alien.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Beginning Saturday morning at 11.
What makes some people act courageously in a scary or dangerous moment? Are they less afraid than the rest of us?
You can never eliminate fear. I can't tame it to zero. So I had to cross that chasm from shame to tame to really transcend.
How to be brave, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
What have we done? That was the reaction of a marine scientist and the first Micronesian woman to explore the deepest part of the Pacific Ocean. The Marianas Trench is more than 7 miles deep. And Nicole Yamase's journey there is detailed in a documentary that won the Pacifica Award at the Hawaii International Film Festival. We talked to Yamase and filmmaker Daniel Lin. Lin also works with Niatero, an organization focused on elevating the role and influence of indigenous people. He starts off talking about how the film Arimatau, People of the Ocean, came together.
Nicole has been living this story for her whole life, and it's a big reflection of her journey and her perspective. And for me, it's a culmination of many years and many relationships and that I've been fortunate enough to have and be a part of over the course of my work throughout the Pacific, especially in across the Micronesia region. And so when we came together and she had her experience and we understood like there's these bigger arcs of stories that are tied throughout the diaspora, the many generations of people that live across Hawaii and the mainland and also in all parts of Micronesia, we just felt like it was a really great opportunity to explore what that would look like through the lens of an individual like Nicole, who has such a unique perspective, but also a very powerful and charismatic voice, but ultimately look at a community story in that regard. So that's why we made it. I think it's our love letter to the people that have nourished and supported us across the region for so long.
And Nicole, talk about the experience, because they followed you around for an awful long time.
They did. And I'm so grateful for them, because in that moment, in those times, you don't realize, like Dan said, we didn't plan for this to go 4 years. And like I said, I'm very grateful to them, because I think these kinds of stories need time to really capture the big moments and low moments of life. But yeah, having them just following me around was weird. I definitely had to get used to it. But I'm grateful that they have all of this footage with my family, me doing field work, me collecting algae, and meeting and speaking with the Remetau community. And all of those, I'm so grateful, because now looking back, watching it, during the filming, I would sometimes get frustrated or just feel uncomfortable with the camera there. But now watching the film, I'm just so grateful that Dan and his team were there to just capture those beautiful moments, because you don't realize these special moments until you really step back and watch the film and be like, oh, okay, this was a moment that needed to be captured and shared with others.
Well, I was very jealous. I was very jealous that you got to go to the bottom of the Marianas Trench, because living in Guam and just learning about it was just always a mystery to me. And when you talked about the marine debris that was on the bottom there, miles deep, it was pretty startling.
Yes, I did not expect to see marine debris down there, especially in a moment where I'm just feeling so proud and so honored to be there and to just take it all in. And then when I see the tethers and the lines at the bottom, then I'm just, my whole mindset kind of just goes to disappointment and embarrassment of what have we done. It's seeing trash at the bottom is a huge red light going off in our faces, but we've already had so many red lights flashing in our faces, and yet we're still continuing what we're doing, just polluting our oceans.
When I think of island cultures and the matriarchal, I guess, viewpoint where we take care of our family and our home, and you want to take care of that debris and that rubbish down in the trench, but that's so far to go, and it just almost seems like an impossible task unless we stop it from getting down there in the first place.
Yeah, and just wonder how much trash. Can you imagine? We're at the bottom of Challenger Deep, and we stumble upon trash. How much trash is there, really? Even Dawn Wright, with the beer bottle she saw the following year, like, how much is down there, and how long has it been there? And yeah, I think with the changing worlds and priorities, things shifting, currents moving and bringing in this trash, we really just need to shift our mindset to how life would be before. What would our ancestors say and do?
And Daniel, you work with Niatero, and that just that whole indigenous perspective of that organization, knowing that you've produced this film and have been able to tell this story, I don't know. How does that make you feel?
I feel in the world of being in the Pacific, and especially seeing the world and the lens and stories through Pacific peoples, there's nothing more sacred than ocean spaces. Right? Ocean spaces are the spaces that unite, that nourish, that connect people. They're the sea lanes of all of the previous voyagers. And so to think of what an ancestral territory means for Pacific Islanders, you could say that the bottom of the ocean is just such a sacred space, especially one that, as deep as it is, it's a space where all creation legends come out of. It's this space where there's this immense amount of life, whether it's seen or unseen, felt or unfelt, it is just sacred. And so the feeling that that is disturbed by what happens on the surface in careless ways is what we wanted to highlight with this film, and just to show that the ocean is not this big kind of dumping ground. It's not it's not this vast, empty, vacuous space. It is it's this place full of life and memory and in of itself. And so we wanted to showcase that what happens, all of these things are interconnected from the top to the bottom.
When I think of the ocean, I think of what gives me strength, right? It powers us, it feeds us. We thrive in the ocean. And with the many threats, there's lots of talk about commercial fishing in some of these pristine areas, undersea mining, lots to guard against.
Yeah, absolutely. Like in the work of communities, coastal communities, indigenous communities all over the world who are guardians of their place, and within those spaces, some of the most special and most intact ecosystems are there, and they're a reminder of what the world, what the earth is and what it was and what it could be. And the ocean is no different, right? What we do to the ocean, if it changes its ecology, changes its, and it disturbs all of that living memory. And so I think doing the work of trying to shed light on how important it is, how important these spaces are, and how important it is to be guardians of our ocean space, is we're just a small part of doing that work. But hopefully storytelling and films like this can be a conversation starter for people who might have their eyes open to it.
And then anything else you want to add, Nicole, just about what happens now?
So now we're really with Remetau, and you've seen that there's so many different powerful levels of the story that can help shape our young minds. One of the big goals that we would like to do is build curriculum, help get Remetau into classrooms, into spaces where our kids and the youth can see who we are, how deep we are connected to the ocean, what can we do to take care of our sacred spaces. And through the work with One Reef like that, working with indigenous communities back home to bring back our traditional ways, knowledge, and perspectives of the ocean so that those could be our North Star of what we do, to make sure that we're all aligned and that we come together to work together to protect and take care of our oceans.
I like that idea of guardians of the sea, or people of the ocean. And any final thoughts, Daniel, just about where you see this film going? It's going to go to Maui this month, but
yeah, it'll be,
where else after
it'll
that?
It'll be in Maui next week. And then, you know, for us, it's really important that it's seen and across the islands, especially across the Northern Pacific and in Hawaii. We would love for it to be, we'd love to get it into kind of university campuses and into other film festivals. But mainly, we just want it to be this conversation starter. Because on many levels, this film asks many questions of our audience. And we're hoping that those questions lead to discussion and dialogue, and whether it's internal, whether it's in community, whether it's in a living room, whether it's in a theater. We really want people to ask, have these difficult conversations about what it means to be in the modern day stewards of place, stewards of culture, stewards of story, and hopefully we can move forward in these healthy discussions. I think that's very needed in Hawaii, but also all across the Pacific and all across the world.
All right, Daniel and Nicole, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Mahalo. The film is Remetau, The People of the Ocean. It will screen at the Maui Arts and Culture Center next week as part of the ongoing art exhibit Ocean of Peace, showcasing Micronesian artists. And fun fact, one of the featured artists, Lisette Yamase, is Nicole's sister. We'll have links on our website later today. That is it for us today. Up tomorrow, we have a call-in show planned around cesspools. Will the state hit its goal to convert all cesspools by 2050? We have a guest host, Yunji Denise, is sitting in for me. Give us some feedback. Leave a voicemail on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.